Welcome to a podcast of Aurelia Community Church, where we desire to bring the whole gospel to the whole person, to the whole world, proclaiming the liberating power of the gospel as we grow, serve, and go. Join us in this message as we look to the scriptures, seeking to be transformed into the image of Christ.
Thanks, team, for leading us. So praise the name of the Lord forever. You know, we're going to be getting into the book of Job in just a couple of minutes. And one of the things Job says, when everything's taken away from him, everything that was valuable, everything that was important to him, he says, "The Lord gave, the Lord's taken away. May the name of the Lord be praised." And there's something about worshiping God in the midst of our pain, in the midst of our hurts, in the midst of all of our disappointments, that enables us to refocus and enables us to see God in a clear way. So we're in this series we're called Take Heart. And the first couple of messages in the series deals with more of the crisis-type situations, though it's applicable, I believe, to all the situations we face. But we're going to get more into the encouragement in the everyday life starting next week. This morning's message I've entitled Embrace the Suck. That may or may not become clear to you in a few minutes. All of us have goals. There's things we want to accomplish. And some of you think life is going along well. Life is fine. Life is orderly. Everything's on track, maybe more or less. Maybe things aren't going quite the way you want them, but you think things are manageable. You're getting along. And then life throws you a curveball. Don't you just love those curveballs? They seem to come out of nowhere. You didn't see it coming. It's random. It's unexpected. Earlier this year, an author and theologian, Rachel Held Evans, 37 years old, two young kids, she got the flu, and she died. It's a curveball. Some of you have been in situations where you get hit by a car. It's an accident. It's a curveball. Everything you'd planned for comes undone. Maybe that marriage you thought you had that was solid, now you're divorced. The disease that the doctor told you about, the collapse of a business, it could be anything, but your life totally gets reframed because of that curveball. An instant, what was normal is no longer there, and things just come undone. Everything you thought was secure and safe is no longer there. And maybe you get angry at God, and you get angry at others, and you get angry at life itself, and you say some ungodly things, and maybe you do some stupid, ungodly things. And most Christians will give you a little bit of grace. Most Christians will give you a little bit of grace space, as long as it doesn't get too crazy, as long as you don't get too far out of control. But often it's a limited grace space. And when you cross that line, you'll find there's a whole line of people wanting to straighten you out, wanting to correct you. So some of you are old enough to remember the movie Airplane, which was a farce on all of the disaster movies at the time. Watch this clip.
I gotta get out of here. I gotta get out of here.
Calm down. Get a hold of yourself.
Let me handle this.
Calm down. I'll get back to your seat. I'll take care of this. Calm down. Calm down. Get a hold of yourself.
Doctor, you want another phone? Everything's been torn by me.
This is great. I'll handle this.
I gotta get out of here.
That's still true. People start to line up, and and you get the whole "my Bible says" crowd. My Bible says, "Rejoice always and give thanks in everything," which is a true statement. But timing's everything, folks. And when you say that to a person in crisis, it just doesn't land well. My Bible says you just got to believe and receive, and you just have to have faith, and you can move mountains, and you can get out of that wheelchair if you have enough faith. And that implies that your lack of faith is what's keeping you in that wheelchair. True things said in the wrong time and the wrong context can be so devastating, can be so destructive. a truth in the wrong environment becomes an untruth. And so you get you just got to stand strong, crowd. You just got to trust. And you got to turn your thoughts towards positive things. And things will start looking up for you. You've got to believe in yourself. And you've got to start praising God like crazy. And you'll be fine. You'll feel better all the time. You just got to. And there's this whole long line of people slapping you in the face. You know, or the people who will say, at least, you know, I'm sorry you lost your husband, but at least you still have your children. I'm sorry you lost your wife, but at least you'll see her in heaven. I'm sorry that you can't have children, but at least you can adopt. At least. And maybe there's a context in which you can say that, and a context in which it's a good thing to say. But in the moment of a crisis, it's a very damaging thing to say. Or there's the, it's all for the better crowd. Yeah, it seems so terrible, so painful, it seems so random. But God's got a plan. He's working it all out. It's all part of His bigger, bigger plan. He's still on the throne. There's a reason for everything. Yeah, yes, there is. And sometimes the reason is you're stupid and you made a bad decision. You know, there was that 19th century hymn by William Cowper. Judge not the Lord by feeble sense, but trust Him for His grace. Behind a frowning providence, He hides a smiling face. You know, tell that to somebody who just lost their child. You know, it's so tragic. It's just, you know, providence is smiling down. You know, and you wonder why some people have difficulty seeing God and seeing the hope that's ours in Jesus Christ. You know, all of this type of thinking, all of this cliched fix-it thinking comes right out of the book of Job. We've got this whole book of Job, and you're looking for it. It's right before the Psalms. It was written to refute that type of thinking. You know, Job goes into crisis. Job's a godly man. He's a wealthy man. And then he loses it all. His crops get destroyed, his cattle, his sheep get destroyed, his kids die. And some of Job's friends come around. I don't know why this has all happened, but they come around, and for 6 days, Job's friends do the right thing. For 6 days, they sit there with Job in the suckiness of life. They sit there with Job and they shut up. They're quiet. They just grieve with him. They give him that grace space. And then Job starts talking. And as Job starts to talk, he says some nasty things about God and to God. You know, he calls God a monster, a cruel beast who's just toying with him. And at one point, he refers to God almost in Satan-like language. And so as he's saying those things about God, Job's friends can't take it anymore. They've got to crack down now. They've got to speak truth. They have to correct Job. They've got to contain this thing. And so they start dumping on them all the stuff they've heard. It's your fault. It's your fault. If you just do this, Job, if you repent, if you turn to me, turn to God, if you give thanks, then everything will be all right. And Job says in chapter 6, and this is verse 19, the caravans of Tema look for water, the traveling merchants of Sheba look in hope. They're distressed because they've been confident. They arrive there only to be disappointed. Job is saying, you guys are like thirsty travelers in the desert. You're looking for water, but you see a mirage. You're hoping for water, but there's nothing there. You see, there's no water in the picture on the screen. That's a mirage. It looks like there's water there, but it's a mirage. And Job says, you've seen my calamity, and you're terrified of that. You're afraid of that. And his calamity, his ordeal, is exposing the mirage quality of their theology. They're drinking from a theology that they think they know everything about God. They think they know what God's about. They think they know what God's doing. And you see, in their world, when anyone suffers, it's because they're being punished by God. And that's what makes sense to them. And Job is saying, no. That's not what my case is. And you see, Job's friends are afraid. They're afraid that if Job's suffering is as random as it seems to be, if Job is suffering as a result of something that they don't know about, they don't know how to handle that. some challenge to God's character, and some random wager was made in the heavenly realms. So these folks want to believe. And I've met lots of Christians who believe the same way. They just want to believe if I'm true to God, if I am faithful, if I'm righteous, if I say my prayers, if I obey the rules, if I do this, if I do that, if I do the right things as I make my sacrifices, God will protect me. I've got all these assurances. But you see, the price of having that assurance is that anybody who's suffering means God wasn't protecting them. Which means there's being punished for something, there's something wrong there. And that's the thinking of Job's friends. They're thinking that what happened to him might happen to them. And so they drink from this mirage theology, this self-serving theology. But Job's exposing that because everyone knows that Job is righteous. He was called a righteous man by God. If you go back to Job chapter 1, and they're going to insist that rather than allow his suffering to challenge their theology, they double down on their theology. They can't handle this kind of chaos. They can't handle this. You got to make sense of this. They can't handle this randomness. They can't handle this ugly.
You can't handle the truth.
Yeah, sometimes they can't handle it. They just impose their version of reality, their version of truth on it. Since we know what must be true, we just assert that it's true. And they say some stupid, stupid things. And a lot of times religious people do that when they're motivated by fear. For example, in Job 4, verse 7, one of Job's friends says, "Consider now, or think now, who being innocent has ever perished? Where were the upright ever destroyed?" Now, that's what you say when you turn off your brain. When have the innocent ever been punished? In the whole course of history, no innocent person has ever been punished. No one that was righteous has ever died. Really? You know, in the ancient world, mortality rates was over 50%. And in many cases, they said, don't name your child until the age of 5 because they have a 50% chance they're going to die. You know, our friend G, who's going to be here next month, one of the things they're doing with some ministry among women in the Afar is basic health care and maternal care. Because right now in the Afar, and these numbers have been decreasing rapidly, 81 out of every 1,000 children born in the Afar die before the age of 5. 15 years ago, that number was over 200. So there's good things happening, but still, there's so much loss. So this guy, this friend of Job, lives in this world where children die all the time, and yet he has the audacity to say, when have the innocent ever perished? How deep do you have to be inside your own head, inside your own religious thinking to make a statement like that? It's absolutely crazy, and it's a testimony to how blind fear-based religion can make a person. How brain-damaged fear-based religion can make a person. What causes people to fly planes into skyscrapers and set women on fire because they think they're witches and torture others because they believe by punishing and by torturing, people will turn to faith. It makes people do crazy stuff. And the book of Job is a testament to that. We're blinded by our fear. We can't take the chaos. We don't understand it. It's just painful. And so we try to impose an order on it. We try to see the world through religious colored glasses. It's all about us. We want the security. We want to know we've got the formula, the guarantee that what's happened to them won't happen to us if we just do these things, if we just believe these things, if we just say these things. And so Job's friends are so fearful that what happened to Job could happen to them. And I think we often fear the pain itself. You know, if I truly empathize with this person, if I acknowledge that situation is as bad as it seems to be, if I get on the inside of that, it's going to hurt. And as I said last Sunday, we all like comfortable order. We don't like painful chaos. And so to invite this in on our lives, it's going to feel like it's going to be painful. And we're afraid of that. It takes courage to step into and walk with somebody through those dark days. The easier route would be to keep it at bay. Try to impose my order, the way I can understand things on it. Tidy it up. Make it look a little better so it fits into to my particular worldview. So it looks like Job's friends are trying to advise him. And no doubt they're sincere about what they believe. But you see, what they're saying is really not about Job at all. It's all about protecting themselves, putting some boundaries up, saying these things for their own sake, trying to maintain their grip on order, not trying to help Job, not trying to minister to him, not trying to come alongside him. And I think sometimes we're so fearful because there are situations that all of us either face ourselves or we know people that we are walking with who are in situations that are too painful for words. They're too deep for words. And there are times that, as Job's friend saw, when the only appropriate response is silence. And most of us are very awkward with silence, so we try to fix it. And then when that gray space begins to run out, we start to get triggered. And our fears start to arise. And that's when things come out of our mouth that are spoken out of fear. And they're not very helpful. So let me give this piece of advice. It's so important, but it's so vital. You have a loved one who's in crisis. There's somebody you know who's in crisis. And you feel called to minister to them. One of the things that's so very important to do is to take an inventory of where you're at as you're approaching them. Ask the question honestly. Is this triggering any of my fear buzzers? Is this causing fear to arise in me? And if it is, name that fear. Face that fear. Embrace that fear. Is this situation triggering my trust in God? Is it making me question or wonder about some things? Is it challenging my perspective on some things? Do I have a fear of facing that fear? What am I afraid of? And maybe if you do that, you're afraid that if I do come close, I'm going to lose it. I'm going to worsen the situation by scaring the other person about how grieved I am by their situation. Maybe that's a fear of yours. You're afraid of becoming completely undone, of not having anything to say or to do that could possibly be helpful. You have to face that reality. Name that reality. Embrace that. And some of you may need to write that down, just as a way of making that process a little bit more manageable. You see, the more we are in touch with our own struggles, our own fears, the less inclined we're going to be to speak out of our fear. If I recognize that that's a fear of mine, then I'm not going to speak that out. And it's not just about people in crisis situations. It could be a situation which would trigger something in you. Monitor where you're at. Embrace the messiness of the whole thing. Ask God to give you the courage to note your fears and press through them. Ask God to give you His perfect love that casts out fear. Ask Jesus to give you a love that's stronger than fear, that gives you the courage to embrace the situation, to embrace the person just as they are. Because the greatest help you can be to another person in crisis, and sometimes the only way you can be a help to a person going through crisis, is to be there. Is to simply to be present. To love that person. To encourage them. To encourage means to breathe courage into them. To encourage. You're breathing courage in them to go on. To take that next step. And when you have the courage to face and overcome your own fears, to be present. Fully present. Let that person's situation on your inside, your courage now is breathing into them. See, being there is so important. But here's the thing, and many of you have learned this. You can't be both empathizing with a person, feeling what they feel, and at the same time have a goal or an agenda to fix that person. You can't do those two things at the same time. In fact, there's some neurological studies, neuroscience studies that show the part of your brain that empathizes, when that part is active, it shuts down the goal-setting part of your brain. And when you're doing goal-setting stuff, the part of your brain that you need to empathize with people shuts down. The two don't work at the same time. You can't be both trying to fix the person and feeling what they feel. That's a fascinating fact, but it really didn't surprise us. You know, most of us guys assume the only reason why you want to talk about problems is you want to fix it, right? You know, I see some nodding heads. So if we were a more vocal congregation, I'd probably hear a few amens. That's why we talk about problems, because we want to provide a solution. You know, problems are unpleasant to talk about, so let's talk about them as little as possible and fix them as quickly as possible. You know, that's not a rational approach, isn't it? It seems so reasonable, except that's not how life works. So we've got this hypothetical question. A hypothetical couple. And she brings up an issue or a problem, and he jumps in with a solution. This is how we can fix it. And because he's good at fixing things. They're good at providing solutions. And that works the first time, and maybe the second time, and definitely not the third time. And so she brings up another issue, another problem, and he wants to fix it, but she wants to keep talking about it. And if you're a wise husband, you let her, because she wants to talk, but then she wants to talk about more about it the next day. And you're thinking, if you're really dumb, you say, you say it. We've already talked about that. Here's the solution. And she says, but that's one solution, but are there some other possibilities? And you go, I don't want other possibilities. I want the simple solution. Let's just do this. I don't want to talk about it for the next 2 or 3 hours. And some of you women are thinking, poor Janice, she's married to a Dr. Spock or something. But remember, this is a hypothetical couple. So one day this guy is driving to work, and on the radio comes an interview with John Gray. John Gray is the author of Men Are From Mars and Women Are From Venus. Sometimes I think he should have titled it Men Are From Mars, Women Are From Who Knows Where, some different dimensions, some different universe or something. But what he said is really, really interesting. And there's a spectrum here. These are he talked very broad, very general categories. There's always exceptions, and there's this range. But generally, he says, men tend to, when they talk about problems, they want a problem solved. That's the reason why they talk about the problem. Women tend to talk about problems for very different reasons. They want to feel like they have a shared concern. They're on the same page in terms of emotional investment in the problem. So now they can solve it together. First comes the connectedness, and then comes the solution. Women want to know we're on the same page. There's a connectedness. We can tackle this problem together. See, you may not realize this, but some brains are completely different than yours. So that person who's in pain in your life, they're not necessarily looking for a solution. They first of all want to know, do you feel my pain? Do you feel my concern? And if you're jumping in to offer solutions, you're not really listening. One church I pastored, we used to offer Alpha on a regular basis. And it was quite successful. We had quite a few people coming to know the Lord. And one of the reasons it was so successful, I believe, is because we asked some people not to attend. Because there was in this case, it was two or three women who were answer people. You know, answer people, they got an answer. They got the answer to every question, every solution. And that doesn't work for Alpha. Because in Alpha, you let people bring up their questions, and you let people wrestle with them. And sometimes they would ask directly for an answer to a question they had, and we'd say, you know, we're going to talk about that in 2 or 3 weeks' time. Or that comes up in week 8. And, you know, by the time we got to week 8 and we got to that discussion around there, they'd already worked through some of those issues, and God had already shown them some things. But you had answer people who just jumped in from every moment. We would have lost them, and they wouldn't have had a chance to listen to what God was saying. Often it's not about the solution to the problem. It's about hearing the person, hearing their soul, hearing their pain, hearing them. We can't be both problem-solving and empathizing at the same time. To empathize, you've got to turn off your fix-it mode. And if you're going to be in fix-it mode, you have to shut off your empathizing mode. And that's true about regular problem-solving and goal-setting. How much more is it about when people are in crisis? People in crisis want to know that they're not alone in their pain. They don't want, nobody wants pity. That's not what it's about. It's about compassion. And compassion means coming alongside us. Compassion is this emotion that you have where you're mirroring the emotion. You're sharing the emotion. You're being on the inside of that. And that means you have to shut off all those goals and agendas and simply embrace the suck. That's a phrase that comes out of the U.S. military. It's not simply a wisecrack type term. It means face it. I've been there. This is not going to be easy. But let's walk through it together. And when things go absolutely crazy, when things seem hopeless, when it's ugly and painful, embrace the suck. See, there are times when life falls apart and comes undone. And sometimes then, the most loving thing you can do, the best thing you can do, and sometimes the only thing you can do, is just embrace the suck as it is. Embrace the person who's in the midst of the mess and all of the garbage and all of the suckiness. Yeah, there may be a time later on to talk about theology and to talk about order and talk about how to move forward. But in that moment, the gift you are bringing them is just you. Not your wise advice, not your great counsel, not your brains, your smarts, not all your solutions to how to fix it, but simply yourself. I don't know how many funerals and funeral visitations I've been to over the years. Far, far too many. And I know that at funerals and funeral home visitations, people say stupid stuff. And people say nasty stuff. But it's never the time to correct their theology. It's never the time to correct what they say. You know, there's so many times where I'll meet with a family 3 or 4 months after they've buried a loved one. And often one of the things they'll say to me is, you know, Mike, so appreciate that you were there and what you said. And I'm rocking my brain. I didn't say anything. I was simply there. I sat with them. And sometimes for an hour or two or three, and you simply sat there with the family. And you let them weep and cry and talk and say all sorts of stuff. It wasn't the time to correct theology. It wasn't the time to get them to understand something new. No, it's time to embrace them. In the book of Job says some weird stuff, some nasty stuff. But at the very end of the book, God shows up. And in chapter 42, the last chapter, he commends Job and gets mad at Job's friends because they spoke out of fear. They were inauthentic. They were serving themselves. They had this mirage theology. And so in Job 42, verse 8, God says, "You have not spoken the truth about me," talking to Job's friends, "as my servant Job has." And the key word here is that Job has spoken straight. Rather than spoken the truth, how the NIV translates it, it's actually in the Hebrew word kun, which means spoken straight. It means to be aligned with. You've spoken straight. Job didn't speak truth all the time. He spoke some error. But he spoke honestly. He spoke authentically. And the whole point of the book is that it proves God's character in the heavenly realm. God is not this master manipulator. And Job vindicates God by being honest. You know, God can take your honesty. You know, we've been reading through the Psalms. And the various people who write, and mostly David, but not exclusively, they say some weird things to God. They get angry at God. They get kicked off at God. But you know what? God can handle our honesty. The most important thing to remember when you're going through a crisis or you know someone who's going through a crisis is to be honest. Speak truth. Speak straight. Say what's real. Don't pretend. Don't try to tidy up. Don't try to say some nice platitudes. Let God love you as you are. Let you be a channel of God's love to others. Being present is your gift. As I was preparing for this, I was doing some reading on a number of related issues, and there's a number of studies that ask the question, you know, what is it about trainers that really help athletes succeed? And most of the studies have shown it's not their expert advice, because you can go to YouTube and get all sorts of training techniques and training tools. It's not the information, but it's the fact that they're invested in their athlete. And the athlete knows that they're not alone. Their trainer understands the sacrifice that's being made. They get on the inside of their hopes and their dreams. And this is a person that's going to be with me when I'm celebrating, when I set a record, when I do better than I have. But they also share in the suckiness of their defeats. Just having a person who's invested with being present is what gives athletes those extra edge. The same is true in terms of psychology. It's not primarily the school of thought that determines how good a counselor is. Specialists fight over what theory is best, but all the empirical evidence points to the fact that it really doesn't contribute an awful lot. There's no provable statistical correlation between a particular school of thought and success rate. Rather, good counselors have a way of communicating with their clients that they're there for them. They're on their side. They're present to them. And regardless of what they say or what techniques they bring, what brings healing, what frees people is the fact that they're simply there for them. Able to communicate that they're valuable. I think we can call this the incarnational principle. In every relationship that we have, the most important thing is to be there. You can have your ideas and your thoughts and your philosophy, you know, all this wisdom and knowledge and stuff, but being there is just so absolutely vital. It's being incarnational. That's what God did with Jesus, isn't it? Jesus came and was born. The message says he pitched his tent, moved into the neighborhood. He became present among us. He dives down into our sin, into our messes, takes the worst that we have to offer and embraces the suck. And the love with which he does that frees us from all of the mess, from all of the crap. God's presence, his loving presence in us at our worst, diving into our hell, taking on our sin. That's what frees the world. That's what we're called to do with others when they're in crisis. It's being there. It's part of the healing. Being there, loving them, that transforms. One of the greatest gifts you have to give is yourself. Caring about, empathizing, even, and maybe especially, if you're silent. You're the encouragement because you have the courage to be there. The courage to be with them. To be present, loving them. No ifs, ands, buts, not trying to fix it, not anything. Just being present, being with them. You are the gift in every relationship, especially in those crisis things. It's not how clever you are or what wise things you have to say. Maybe you've got some wisdom to share, and there may be times for that. But being there, being fully there, fully present, lovingly there, that's the gift. The incarnation. But as I said, let me back up just a wee bit. Monitor yourself. You know, be asking you the questions. Is this activating fear in me? And you might be surprised that, yeah, there probably is a little bit of fear there. We usually don't get in touch with that. We just see the effects of it when we start talking because we start saying stupid things. But get in touch with that. Ask God for wisdom about how to be present. But what to say and what not to say. But most importantly, ask God for the courage to be present. One last thing, and I'll end with this. If you're the one who's in crisis, if you're the one who his life has become undone, don't be alone. That's a prescription for disaster. You need to get connected with somebody. Don't listen to the lies that you can handle this on your own. Don't listen to the lies that no one else can ever understand. You know, one of the good things that's happened in the last, within the last decade, is the schools have started to have buddy benches. If someone's not playing, they don't have a friend to play with, they go sit on the buddy bench, and everyone knows they need a friend, somebody to play with. You know, we need to be okay with having buddy benches. We need to be okay with asking, inviting someone to come in on my situation. Say, I don't know what I need, but can we chat? And if someone asks you for that, say yes and shut up and let them talk. person to let them talk. Because we need to come to that place where we recognize that God's the one who brings the healing. God's the one who brings the restoration. God's the one who brings hope into the midst of that. I'm going to invite our worship team to come back up. And they're going to lead us in a song that declares, "It's well with my soul." Not because of all the stuff that we are, but because of who He is. And throughout this series, we're always going to be giving an opportunity. If you need somebody to pray with you, or you just want to pray by yourself, the front the platform here's open, and just come and just cry out to God, or say, "Can someone pray with me about this?" Because as we leave here, as we go into our neighborhood, into our city, into our community, into our schools, into our workplaces, we recognize we get all of our life from Jesus. We want to be people who have the courage to face our fears and have the courage to love people as they are, embracing the suck as it is. Team.
We pray that God will use this message to strengthen your faith and draw you into a deeper relationship with Jesus. If you're interested in other sermons or want to know more about Aurelia Community Church, please visit our website at www.occweb.org.